New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof earned his stripes as a foreign correspondent writing from many of the world's hotspots.
You regularly meet people with guns who just might kill you.
His reporting from China and Sudan even earned him 2 Pulitzer Prizes.
I saw peasants, rickshaw drivers who were risking their lives.
Nick Kristof's our guest in the hour ahead as he reveals why he remains optimistic about the state of the world.
There is a lot going on that is good that we don't always acknowledge.
And Andrew Pryor scours the streets of Paris to help us experience the most delicious city in the world the way he and his neighbors do.
Buy your cheese, buy your baguette, buy your wine, get some great chocolates, and head off down to Le Loyer Park and maybe sit there and enjoy a great picnic.
Grab a pastry from the corner bakery and catch up on one of our favorite columnists. It's just ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. Reporting on the news from the world's conflict zones has a powerful way of showing you the value of life and the meaning of home. In just a minute, we're delighted to talk to New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof to hear what he's learned from a career as a top-notch journalist. And an Australian cook and podcaster living in France shares tips for enjoying the fabulous food scene in Paris affordably, the way he and his neighbors do. That's a little later in the hour on today's Travel with Rick Steves. For the past 40 years, Nicholas Kristof has been writing for the New York Times. As a foreign correspondent, as a bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and as a columnist. In his new book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, he provides a candid look at his work, the lessons he's learned, and why good journalism remains so important to our democracy. Nick joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Oregon's Willamette Valley to let us stow away with him on the road as a foreign correspondent. Nick, it's so good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Boy, oh boy, I got to say, I'm a little tired right now because I couldn't put your book down last night. It is, what a story you have to tell. And, you know, this is a travel show, and Chasing Hope is really a collection of great travel moments from the memories of a foreign correspondent. A lot of skills in extreme travel that you employ to do your work.
Yeah, I mean, we've both figured out how to travel for a career, in a sense, and see the world. And it's been an amazing journey, I think, for both of us.
You know, for instance, I love you wrote about the best seat on the train in Sudan is on the roof. You've had some memorable best seats, I think.
I mean, it truly is. I mean, you know, inside there are rats and cockroaches, and on the roof, you're out in the open, and I mean, the only thing you worry about is you see all these carcasses of other trains that derailed, and you kind of wonder about the people who've been on top of those trains.
Yeah. You know, the great thing I took away from Chasing Hope is your optimism, your ability to see the bright side. I mean, a lot of people would say you're just reporting on the worst of humanity, but at the same time, you see something else.
Yeah, Rick, I mean, I think that's a mistake that we in journalism make, that we... Look, I mean, bad news is news, and we have to cover the terrible news. But I think we don't often enough provide the context, the trajectory of improvement that underlays that. When I first began traveling the world in the early 1980s, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, there was so much blindness everywhere that was really left a deep impression on me, from river blindness, from trachoma, from cataracts, et cetera. And now there is so much less blindness, you know, more tumbled extraordinarily because of the work of Jimmy Carter and 1,000 other people.
Right.
Likewise, you know, I think maybe the worst thing that could happen to somebody is to lose a child. And when I was born, that 1/5 of babies died before the age of 5. Mm. When I graduated from college, 11% did. And now we're down to, this year, we'll set a new record for an all-time low in the share of children dying by the age of 5, a little more than 3%. You know, there is a lot going on that is good that we don't always acknowledge.
Well, you wrote something like, when you're doing your reporting, covering events, that's 75% of it is bad, and that's what gets covered over trends. In trends, 75% of it is good.
Exactly. We cover events, which are mostly bad, and we don't much cover trends, which are mostly good. And, you know, obviously, there are exceptions. And I think people sometimes feel that, oh, if you pay too much attention to the good news, somehow you're, you know, being complacent about the risks.
Yeah.
And I don't see that at all. I think it fortifies us to take on those challenges, which are very real.
You and I are both interested in world hunger in a world with such abundance and affluence. How can this be? And it can be very depressing when you look at how extreme poverty, people trying to live on less than about $2 a day, has ticked up in the last decade. But if you look at it in a broader scope, in our lifetime, it's cut by about half, hasn't it?
Yeah. And extreme poverty rose during the pandemic a little bit. I mean, the data is still fragile post-pandemic, but it appears to have come back down. And like when I graduated from college, 41% of the world's people lived in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. Now we're at about 8%. So, but there's been an incredible improvement.
The challenge for any journalist who's wanting people to read his stuff is not to get sucked into what will be my best writer's equivalent of clickbait, but what will really tell the story that needs to be told.
Yeah. I mean, so what I tell people is that side by side with the worst of humanity, you encounter the very best.
Yeah.
And so I've met a lot of warlords. I've seen covered genocide and war, you know, that has left a deep impression on me. I've seen a lot of massacres. But when you are in the field in that way, you also see these just heroic figures who just, you're just in total awe of them.
You know, there's a photograph in your book of a little boy who was clearly malnourished in Yemen, I think. And you and him do a fist bump.
A fist bump, yeah. That was in Yemen.
So, Nick, when you look at his face, so full of life and joy in a, seems like such a miserable world for him, what do you think?
One of the lessons, Rick, from travel, and I'm sure you felt that, is that you go to far-off places and you just understand that fundamentally we're all so much alike.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here's this little boy in Yemen at the middle of a civil war from a culture that could not be more different than her own. And he's so much like my kids. And I see him and I see my two sons in him. And yet it also breaks your heart because he's not getting the nutrition that my sons are getting. He's not getting those opportunities. And it just reminds one that, you know, the adage that talent is universal, but opportunity is not.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof, and he's just released a memoir about his life as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and his book is called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Nick gives vivid accounts of lessons learned from traveling into major conflict zones and into nearly every corner of this planet. His opinion column appears twice a week in the New York Times. Nick, we're talking about like extreme travel skills that you've picked up as a foreign correspondent, getting the best seat, being an optimist, meeting people. In your work, you meet people in dangerous situations, and I was fascinated by your skill at taking what seems to be something that could really be deadly and defusing it by flattering your captors. Talk to me a little bit about that.
As a foreign correspondent covering wars, or as a columnist covering wars, you regularly meet people with guns who just might kill you. And so it does become, you know, a crucial skill to defuse that. And what you do, you walk up to them, you shake their hands, you look them in the eye, you maybe ask a little about their family or themselves, and you indicate your interest in interviewing them. And warlords tend to think that they have something important for the world to hear, and so they tend to be willing to talk to a reporter. And, you know, it's pretty clear that then if they shoot me, their views are not going to get published. So they then become dependent on me surviving and getting out to write
something. I think that's brilliant. You wrote they like to pontificate, so give them a chance.
Yeah, and, you know, you are careful, and if they decide to rob you, you should have a decoy wallet in, you know, that you can hand over that has some respectable amount of money, but not everything. You know, if a gunman asks for your wallet, it's only polite to offer him a wallet, but you don't want to give him your real one.
With these sort of skills you have, you've got to get into the action and talk to the people. I mean, you told a story in your book about in Afghanistan, how these guys make a fake camp. And then they make money telling Americans about the camp. Round that story out, because it's just amazing what you learn just by sleuthing.
Yeah, this was during the Afghan war. And it was one of the moments when I realized that maybe this is going to be an uphill battle for us, that we have all of the weaponry, but we don't necessarily have the understanding and intelligence to make it work. And so these Afghans were telling me how they would set up a kind of a fake Taliban camp on a hilltop with a fire and some tents around it. And then they would sell to the U.S. the information about where the supposed Taliban camp was. And then the U.S. would drop, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of bombs on this set of empty tents. Mm. And then a day or two later, these entrepreneurs would go and pick up the metal and sell it for recycling. And so they made money two times around on that process. And meanwhile, the U.S. was spending a lot of money bombing dirt.
My goodness. You must just feel like you hit the jackpot when you get a story like that. And you can translate it into things that Americans need to know. I mean, you know that we pay about $1 million a year to keep a soldier in Afghanistan. And you learned about how much of that $1 million gets leaked through corruption and actually funds the Taliban, right?
Yeah, I was talking to some Afghan business people who were working for the U.S. military and shipping equipment for the U.S. military. And they were explaining how they had to pay very large sums to the Taliban to get the U.S. supplies through the Taliban checkpoints. And the upshot was that the large amounts of what the U.S. government was paying for transport were actually going to the Taliban to fund, you know, a large number of Taliban soldiers. So we were fighting the Taliban, who were being paid with our military budget in part. And again, it was just a reminder of how complicated it is and the burden we have in trying to carry out policies in distant countries and cultures.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. His latest book is a memoir, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Do you ever think about the value of soft power compared to hard power and what that $1 million could do? I know you're into women's issues and water and poverty in the developing world. You know, $1 million could drill 100 wells for 100 thirsty communities. And I always think that would be more effective in making us safe than bombing a fake camp on some hillside in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's good data on the wells, but there is good data on education and especially girls' education and the impact that has on conflict. Over time, educating girls has a real impact on the propensity of a country to engage in violence, partly because as women become more empowered, they have more voices in the community, they are more of a restraining influence, and partly because of the impact on fertility that you educate a boy and he will have fewer children, but it's a somewhat small effect. You educate a girl and it has a dramatic effect on the number of children she will have. And when you have fewer children, you have less of an age population that is skewed young. Mm-hmm. And young populations tend to be more militaristic, more likely to have rebellions. And so, you know, this isn't an immediate effect. It takes time to educate people to see this through. But if we had done this after the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, I think that Afghanistan would be a safer, more friendly country, and Afghans themselves would be way better off.
There's more with reporter and columnist Nicholas Kristof in just a minute as we take a closer look at the role that honest journalism plays in advancing democratic societies, despite the economic threats many newspapers and broadcasters are facing. Later in the hour, we'll get you ready to enjoy the food scene in Paris. An Aussie expat recommends how you can enjoy the most delicious city in the world like the locals do. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Working as a newspaper reporter, covering some of the world's most intense conflicts and atrocities, could easily turn you into a cynic. Nicholas Kristof is with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his 40 years of experiences and life lessons reporting for the New York Times, and the people that saved his neck as he sought to report the truth to the outside world. His memoir is called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You know, Nick, you wrote about the frustration from a reporter who's gone to great lengths to get this information. When you bring the story home, it gets people all excited about that particular instance and wanting to help that particular person, but not really tuned into the larger problem, which is really the purpose of the journalism to start with.
Yeah, this came up all the time. You know, I would be writing about, say, starvation in some hunger crisis, and I would choose as my subject to put a human face on it. One particular family, and the mom is trying to figure out whether to feed this child or that child. And then I would get a torrent of letters from people all wanting to know how they can send money to that one family. And from my point of view, it's great that this one family will get support, but I want to solve problems more structurally. that doesn't come from helping just one family. And so over time, I increasingly tried to figure out ways of working with aid groups or others so that people would channel their support for a larger population, not just one really lucky family.
Yeah, it's sort of a human nature to want to help that one person who's been humanized. We can identify with that person. And I always think there's sort of levels of sophistication in somebody's philanthropy. I mean, some people need a photograph of that particular person they're putting through school in Somalia on their mantle, which is a great thing. But I think when you think more about it, if you can impact policies, trade policies, or empower an NGO that's doing good work to give a whole society a chance to work and get ahead, that's going to accomplish a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do think, as you say, that we're motivated by individual stories. And so I certainly have nothing against the aid groups that do try to connect people one by one, because I think that does bring out donors who otherwise wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
But, you know, education in particular is just such a cheap intervention. It's something that we kind of know how to do. And it is just so transformative. And it's one that has really worked. You know, when we were kids, Rick, a majority of human beings had always been illiterate. And there was a huge male-female gap in literacy. Mm-hmm. Today, we're pushing 90% adult literacy. And the gender gap is declining, is much, much lower.
I want to talk a little bit about journalism itself and your work, Nick. It seems to me this is kind of a look back on 40 years of work with the New York Times. And it's divided into two halves, isn't it, Nick? The first half was a foreign correspondent and then more recently opinion columnist?
Yeah, that's fair.
How are those two different? Just give us a kind of an understanding of the two jobs.
Well, so as a foreign correspondent, I was stationed abroad in China, in Japan, in Hong Kong, and I was traveling, you know, all the time. And I wasn't trying to tell people what to think. I was just covering issues. And then as a columnist, I've been stationed in the U.S., although traveling a great deal. I've been building my columns around opinions and making arguments. I should say that I think that's a little less true in my case than in the case of most correspondents and columnists. And, you know, when I was covering China in the aftermath of the Tiananmen democracy movement, I think readers kind of figured out that I disapproved of massacring student protesters.
Yeah.
And when I was writing about the Darfur genocide as a columnist, the interesting thing about what I wrote was not the opinion that genocide is bad. It was the reporting about the fact of the genocide itself.
Can you be a foreign correspondent without being an agenda journalist if you have a big heart?
Yeah, I think one can. And, you know, in truth, Rick, I don't think that our opinions really change people's minds very much on issues that they've thought about. I think that our foremost power as journalists, whether as correspondents or as columnists, is really the ability to project an issue that has been neglected, project that onto the agenda and make people think about it and talk about it. And I always try to make people spill their coffee in the morning. And on the theory that then if they spill their coffee, they would take some action, they would reach out to the member of Congress.
Right.
And, you know, I saw change.
That's a great modifier for all the hard work you do. So we need that fourth estate to tell us the truth of what's going on in our democracy so we can be better citizens.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, the fourth estate is going to be a bit of a referee in the debate. And, you know, look, we in journalism, we screw up all the time. We mess up facts. We do all kinds of things wrong. But we're, you know, like all referees, but it's so much better having us in the field than having nothing.
But if you look at how that applies to today, I mean, when you look at a rally with Trump, he's looking to the back row and he's saying, there's the journalist. They're the problem.
Yeah.
What's he trying to do? Because he's got a playbook.
He's trying to intimidate the refs and or drive out the refs or discredit the refs. And he's doing that to journalists, but also to judges, to lawyers, to the other traditional referees. You know, we think of ourselves as a nation of laws, and we are. But a lot of what keeps America going is guardrails that are really more about norms than about laws and expectations. And I think he's trying to discredit those and undermine those norms and the referees. And he put, you know, he put a lot of pressure on journalists, and journalists originally didn't really know what to do. And I think we totally screwed up in 2016 when he first ran. I think we covered him the way we covered other candidates. And I don't think We conveyed to the public what we knew, which was that he lied to a degree that no other political candidate has in my lifetime in America. And I think we failed the American public.
Nicholas Kristof's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. In his memoir, Chasing Hope, Nick reveals why he's an optimist, despite all he's seen in his work reporting from the world's hotspots. Nick's joining us from his family farm in Oregon's Willamette Valley, where he started out as editor of his high school newspaper. Today, you'll see his op-ed columns twice a week in the New York Times. You can find out more about Nick's family farm, where they make cider and wine, at kristoffarms.com. You know, in our lifetimes, Nick, I think there's been a fundamental change in journalism in the fact that it's gone from kind of news to entertainment. I mean, when Walter Cronkite said, "That's the way it is," I mean, that really was the way it was, because the network did not want to make money during the news hour, right? That was their contribution to our democracy, was not to have, if it bleeds, it leads journalism, if they could avoid it, just to get more money on their advertising.
I think part of it was that news organizations, and certainly newspapers, had to some degree monopolies locally, and they also had a certain sense of responsibility to the public. And they had, I mean, they had a great business model. And then that just kind of fell apart with the internet. And it is continuing to fall apart. It is, you know, done enormous damage to newspapers. But I think cable television is under threat. You know, broadcast radio is under threat, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody is scrambling for audience at a time when they kind of know what the audience is looking after.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a lot harder to convince a news organization to go off and cover the war in Congo, which is the most lethal conflict since World War II, rather than, you know, put a celebrity in the studio and interview him or her.
A few years ago, I read a book by Mort Rosenblum called Escaping Plato's Cave, and he was lamenting how they were not employing foreign correspondents as much anymore. And that was 15 years ago. And you talk about that, too, in your book, how journalism on the cheap really... we take a big hit in the value of journalism when we can't pay foreign correspondents to get out there and be on the spot.
And it's really hard, because the underlying issue is that audiences are less interested in it. There was a period there when I was covering Iraq where every trip from the Baghdad airport to downtown Baghdad to the New York Times Bureau, every trip cost $10,000 because of security to keep you alive in that 45-minute journey. And the New York Times was willing to pay that, and so we covered Iraq. But, you know, a lot of other organizations just could not afford that, especially at a time when there was less interest in Iraq.
You know, this relates to a quote that you shared in your book, Chasing Hope, from Elie Wiesel. And if I got it right, Wiesel said, "What hurts a victim the most is not the brutality of the oppressor, but the silence of the bystander." It seems that that motivates you in your work a little bit, and it must motivate a lot of foreign correspondents.
Absolutely. You know, we have a spotlight, and so we can go places and shine a light on places, on people imperfectly, raises the cost to the oppressor of genocide or mass atrocities. It brings a little more attention, a little more aid to those people, and it does help. And I've seen that in the case of the Darfur genocide 20 years ago in Sudan. There were hundreds of thousands of people who were killed. And, you know, that was so frustrating when I was covering that. But there are also hundreds of thousands of people who are alive today because of news coverage, because of the works of nonprofits, of churches and synagogues and mosques to try to raise attention to the crisis. And so imperfectly, it really does make a difference when we get that attention.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're learning from Nicholas Kristof about the value of foreign correspondence and good journalism. His book is Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Nick, it's so interesting to think about the value of the travel moments you've had and how that translates into powerful and important journalism. A few things that I've noticed when I've been traveling in the developing world is, when I was in Ethiopia, somebody mentioned you've got road bias because I was staying on the paved road. And I noticed in your book that you go to great lengths to get off the grid and then spot check statistics. Find a child, in a land that's supposed to have good education and say, what's 4 plus 8? And see if they really know how to add. Have you thought much about the problem of road bias and how you have to make a point to get away from that?
I have, you know, partly because I grew up in and you know, now speaking to you from a place that is off the road from my family farm in rural Oregon. You know, I don't think that people in Washington necessarily know a great deal about what is happening in towns, little hamlets like mine. So when I go off to a place like Ethiopia, I'm also a little bit skeptical about how much English speakers in the capital are going to know about what is going on in rural Ethiopia.
That was one of my big, big concerns during the Sandinista Contra time is I felt that powerful people from our country were going down and meeting with people on the rooftop garden of the Intercontinental Hotel,
yep.
And they weren't getting out in the barrio. And it occurred to
totally.
Me, you know, a travel writer is like a medieval jester. You know, he gets out there and he hangs out with the people in the barrios and he knows what the jokes are against the king and so on. And then he goes back behind the walls of the fortress and he can tell the king to his face what the people are really thinking. And in a sense,
I think it's exactly right.
You're a medieval jester. you're bringing home the truth and annoying the people in power.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting when we travel that we encounter things we'd never encounter at home? I always think that you learn a lot about your own reality on this planet by leaving home and looking at it from a distance. We take so much for granted, like our democracy, or when you travel in the developing world, I'm always impressed. You see a lot of jerry cans. I never even thought of jerry cans before. Do you know what I mean about that?
Yeah, the importance of power. And I used to look down a little bit on the aspirations for democracy from peasants in various places and thought, they don't really know what democracy is. And then at Tiananmen Square in 1989, I saw peasants, rickshaw drivers who were risking their lives for that democracy that maybe they couldn't define, but they cared about so passionately. And I wish that in this country, we had a little bit more of that passion to sustain the democracy that we already have.
Nicholas Kristof has won Pulitzer Prizes for his columns on Darfur and for his coverage of China, reporting with his wife, Cheryl Wudun. They've also written 5 books together. Nick's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his career as a reporter and foreign correspondent, which he outlines in his latest book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. You'll find links to his work in the notes for this week's show. That's at ricksteves.com/radio. Nicholas, as I was reading through the book, I kept thinking, for you, there must be examples of where you're really proud of our country, America, and also where you're ashamed of our country. Can you give me an example from your reporting? What comes to mind when you think of how you're proud of our nation and how there are cases where you're just not very proud of it?
The one where I'm, you know, where I'm really proud of it was our response to AIDS. When I began to cover AIDS around the world, it just loomed, especially over Southern Africa, as this sword of Damocles, and it was destroying societies. And then the U.S., under President George W. Bush, started a program called PEPFAR that was transformative for these countries. And I first understood the degree to which it was transformative when I visited in Malawi and Lesotho. I talked to undertakers, and they were coffin makers, and they were saying that, you know, the coffin making business was collapsing because people weren't dying anymore because of PEPFAR. And it had saved 25 million lives. This is something that we should truly be proud of. And then I think in terms of things that I'm not proud of, I think that we've so often reached for weapons, and because we have a great army, that we tend to think that the solution to problems is going to involve guns. And sometimes that's true. And I think we need a strong military. But I think, you know, in my lifetime, whether it's in Vietnam or Iraq in particular, I think we were much too quick to reach for weaponry in ways that did not advance our own interests and were devastating to civilians.
You know, on the cover of your book, I kind of expected to see a photograph of you with a helmet on, ducking for cover in some broken state. But you are clearly the face, the happiness on your face, and your arms outstretched, surrounded by the great nature of the Pacific Crest Trail. And it's a shot of you as you were hiking from the border of Mexico to the border of Canada and having a great time with your daughter. What a very interesting stage in your life you're in now, growing apples and grapes with your children on a farm in Oregon and hiking the Pacific Crest Trail.
I mean, it's a wonderful thing about the world today that I can be a New York Times columnist and write books and be on the family farm and produce, first-rate wine and cider. And it's a great learning experience. As a liberal columnist, I rarely meet a regulation I don't like. And as a small business owner, I'm periodically outraged by this or that regulation.
That's great.
And it's a good instinct to discover. It's a good thing to discover.
And I'm curious about this. You've spent a career watching over other actors and assessing their deeds. And the last words in your book, in some sort of acknowledgement at the very end, you say, "You're with your children on a farm in Oregon while being watched by elk, bear, and eagles." So is that tied into you being oversight and now they've got oversight?
I must say that I have oversight over the bears and cougars and elk as well. But it just, in writing the book, Rick, I actually kind of self-diagnosed myself with a certain amount of PTSD from covering war and genocide. And I think I self-prescribed myself a certain amount of wilderness therapy, and that is behind perhaps my hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail, and also I think by my love for the farm and this beautiful spot and the wildlife here.
I think a lot of us can be inspired by that, and we can go out and boldly better understand the world by grappling with it, and we can come home, I think, knowing all in all the world's a good place. It's filled with love. It's filled with joy. And we have a lot to be thankful for and a lot to take care of.
Oh, we sure do. We sure do. If you wanted to choose one time in the history of humanity, you would probably want to choose this time. Mm-hmm. And, you could do a lot worse than choosing, from my point of view, the Pacific Northwest.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you so much for joining us and best wishes with your work. And thanks for writing Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life.
Great to be with you, Rick.
We're heading for Paris next as we check in with a local author who's dedicated himself to finding the very best bistros, bakeries, cheese shops, department store food halls, and kitchen supply shops in the world's most delicious city. It's Travel with Rick Steves. In 2012, Andrew Pryor was a Melbourne-based insurance underwriter by day and a passionate foodie by night. But 9 months in Paris sparked a personal gastronomic revolution. Soon, he quit his job, competed on MasterChef Australia, relocated to Paris, and enrolled in a course at the prestigious Le Cordon Bleu Institute. Andrew now teaches cooking courses from his French home in Western France. He hosts the fabulously delicious podcast and has just published a book called Paris, A Fabulous Food Guide to the World's Most Delicious City. He joins us today on Travel with Rick Steves from his home, and he's ready to talk about the city of light, love, and good food. Andrew, bonjour.
Bonjour, Rick. Thank you for having me on.
It is so great to have you. And I got to say, I'm fascinated by an Aussie French foodie. You're from Australia. You fell in love with France. You moved in and now you've got a career going on just turning people on to the wonders of French food. And you've got an Aussie background. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage?
For the language, I would say it's a disadvantage because it's really hard to get my way around those accents. But everything else, it's definitely an advantage because maybe the French government might not like Australia sometimes, but everybody else in France certainly does.
That's true. Aussies are just, you meet Aussies on the road and you guys know how to travel and you love the world and you always just bring a levity, a lightness, an accessibility to the joys of the world, I think. And that seems to be a theme of yours. Now, on the subtitle of your book, you call Paris the world's most delicious city. That's a big claim.
It is. And I think it definitely has become this. I wouldn't say it's always been that. But definitely, it's become the world's most delicious city in my eyes. It's a lot more cosmopolitan towards what it used to be. And I think that the French have definitely embraced good food in Paris. And so that means that all of the rest of us get to be the lucky recipients of it as well.
You wrote in your book, Is Paris a Foodie City? Paris's food scene has for some time not been up to the standard of modern foodie cities around the world, at least in your opinion. Nor has it in any way, shape, or form acquired the same reputation as French cuisine overall. Then you write, but after emerging from the worst of the global financial crisis about a decade ago, this has changed. So what has changed in Paris? Because, I've never thought of it really as, the quintessential place to go for fine French cuisine, but it has changed in the last decade.
It has. And I think the first thing that changed was the fact that the French came back to Paris. And so a lot of French chefs, you know, they didn't, it was too hard to have a restaurant there, or it was supposed to appeal to the masses. And so they couldn't get to do the food that they wanted to do. And mm-hmm. there just wasn't the French living there that wanted to appreciate good food like that. And so they left. They left to other countries. How many French chefs I met in Australia before the financial crisis when I was enjoying food? I met so many. Oh, yeah. Because it was so much easier to get a job there and to open a restaurant there that everybody was going to love their food. But a lot of those people came back and they've set up restaurants and places of their own right back in Paris.
Now, when I'm working on my guidebook to France, I counsel people, if you want to spend a lot of money on my scale for a dinner, $60, $70, do it in a small town rather than in Paris and you'll get a better value. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's still the case?
Definitely that is the case, but I would say that the difference for that is the menu du jour and also the lunch menu. So definitely a lunch menu at, say, a Michelin-starred restaurant, you can get the same quality food but for half the price. And so that's right. Where I would go. I would go to a Michelin-starred restaurant at lunch and be like the French, have the menu du jour.
You know, you're mentioning Michelin star. I have, when I'm updating my books, I really put a lot of focus on the restaurants. And what I find for my travelers is a Michelin rated restaurant sometimes can be the value we're looking for. And I think there's even a word for that, bib gourmand.
Bib gourmand, absolutely. There's even a newer one now that I think is really fabulous, and that is for the green rated restaurants. And so there's a bib, bib vert, I think they're calling it. And so that is something for sure that I would look out for.
Well, you just, because when you travel, you see that prestigious red plaque on a restaurant.
Yeah.
And if it has a star, you can pretty much assume it's going to be expensive, pretentious. You got to have a reservation. You got to dress up, all that kind of stuff. But if it's just Michelin rated, it's a little more casual, a little more accessible, half the price, but still really good cuisine, beautifully presented and with a smart clientele. I really like that. Nice presentation and a smart clientele without the pretense. By the way, Andrew, you mentioned the green-rated restaurant. Mm. I hadn't heard of that. I just know that in my mind, there's Michelin. When Michelin rates a restaurant, that's great. And if it rates a restaurant and it gets a star, that puts it in the upper echelon, and then they compete to get more stars. But how is green different than simply rated?
So the green restaurants are all about sustainability. So sustainability in their food, in their restaurant ideas. There's a lot of newfangled vegetarian, vegan restaurants that are getting that green rating as well.
So is a green rating something that can go with or without the red rating?
And absolutely,
it's just,
yeah.
It can be red and green, or it could be green without red.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel that what the Michelin, in my opinion, what they're trying to do is that they're trying to appeal to more and more people and have more and more options for people, because basically that's what it was. It was a guide created for drivers that were driving around France
on where Michelin
they're
going to
go. I know, that were Michelin tires.
After being a contestant on MasterChef Australia, Andrew Pryor moved to Paris in 2016, where he now hosts a French food podcast called Fabulously Delicious. He also offers food tours and cooking classes from his home in Montmorillon, a couple hours by train from Paris in the countryside of Western France. His book is Paris, a fabulous food guide to the world's most delicious city. His website is andrewpryorfabulously.com. Now, Andrew, your book, it's just a fun book. It's just, an easy-to-get-your-brain-around blitz through all the dimensions of eating and enjoying the food scene in Paris, whether it's in restaurants or in the markets. And I'd like to talk about a few things that you highlight in your book. First of all, department store food halls. This is really interesting for people, and kind of a surprise that we would recommend going in. A lot of times it's the basement, right? But just wonderful food halls in big modern department stores.
Paris does a lot of things well, and one of them is department stores and definitely food halls. I had the experience in 2015, it was, of going on a private tour of the Galeries Lafayette food halls with their historian.
Oh, yeah.
Not only was it fabulous because they gave us lots of free food, but also a lot of information about the department store, and that was really great. But these halls are just... they're having a really big revival in the last 10 years, and all the department stores have renovated them. And you'll often find they'll have different levels. So there'll be like one level that will have just the same things that you would find on a normal street in Paris. So your boulangerie, your patisserie, butcher, etc. Then another level will have where you will be able to buy food and take it home, but also buy it and have it cooked for you there. So, you know, it might be a poissonnerie, so they sell fish, but you can actually sit down at the table, choose the fish that you want and have that made for you.
We should make this clear that these are department stores in Paris or anywhere for that matter. They can be the Galerie Lafayette with the beautiful Art Deco dome or the Art Nouveau dome and so on. Or it could just be a practical department store.
Yeah.
And knowing French sensibilities and love of food, you can imagine the food is treated just as lovingly as the cosmetics and perfumes and clothing and so on. And you want to find that food floor. As you said, there's the normal groceries you'd expect to find, but there's always, it seems to me, a sort of an edible souvenir area where you get the classic traditional gifty edibles that you can have in a jar, or you could even have that deli kind of counter where you can pick up something right there and sit down and eat it, or take it back to your hotel room or to a park in Paris and eat really good food at takeaway grocery store prices. And it's just a great practical thing to know if you want to eat smartly in Paris.
Absolutely. You know, picking up a baguette and getting a basket full of things from that food hall and then going down to the River Seine on a summer night, it's the perfect thing. Just make sure that the can that you get has one of those openings that you can open the can. You don't have to have a can opener. And the bottle of wine, you might find it hard to get a screw top in France, but, you know, you could search and search for one.
It's an excuse to buy a corkscrew as a souvenir,
exactly.
I suppose. And travelers can do that, sit down on a free chunk of the riverfront and have their own picnic.
Absolutely. And another little tip there, if you want to be very Parisian and be like the Parisians and hang out with the young folk, is to go to Canal Saint-Martin, because that's also a fabulous spot to sit by the canal there and have your dinner. It's an amazing experience.
So our listeners can tell through your wonderful Australian-tinted French accent, that would be St. Martin's Canal, right?
There you go.
St. Martin's Canal. Say that again.
Canal
Saint-Martin. Saint-Martin. Great. I got to say, this is kind of a tangent, but when we talk about great department stores, if you go to London and you've been to Harrods, there's a department store, and the food department there is like, you'd pay admission to see that if you're a foodie, just to see how the food is displayed and celebrated. And all over Europe, you can find these department stores that have these top end food sections. Now, related to that, Andrew, is outdoor food markets.
Yes.
And that's something that you wrote in your book. Just as important in Paris to go to the Louvre or see them or go to the Eiffel Tower, food markets are a way of life in Paris for every Parisian. And it's here that you'll see the real Paris. Tell us about the importance of these food markets and where we might go.
Well, they are the way that you shop. I mean, it's not just Paris, it's all of France. But really, even in Paris, it's the way to get not only food that's, you know, locally grown, but also to have people. One of my favorite markets is the Bastille Market. Right in the middle of the market is some people that make crepes, and they come from Breton. So, you know, and they come down on Thursday. They stay in a caravan outside of Paris, and they do the markets, and they're there on Sundays at the Bastille Market, and then they go back home afterwards. They do that every week. And they've always been there. And every time I'm in Paris, I'm there. Even when we first moved to Paris, we lived right near there. So I would walk every Sunday to the market. But then we moved just a little bit further away. But I still made my way there every Sunday with one of the dogs.
Andrew, are these markets daily markets, or 5 or 6 or 7 days a week, or are they just like a Tuesday market or something like that?
Yes, so every area will have a market on a certain day, and it's usually 2 days a week. And you can just Google in Paris market times, and you will find that. But each one will be different.
I want to remind everybody who's dreaming about Paris, you're going to go to the Orsay, you're going to go to the Louvre, you're going to take a boat ride on the river. Put on that list, visit a food market and find out what day and where. The one you mentioned that you like is Bastille.
Oui.
Okay, Andrew, let's go now to food streets, because anybody who loves Paris, they'll know about Rue Montorgueil. How do you pronounce that? Montorgueil?
Montorgueil.
Montaigu, and I love Rue Claire and Rue de Martyrs, Rue de Rosier. Paris is a collection of neighborhoods, and each neighborhood would have a street dedicated to food shops and sometimes more restaurants or sometimes more food shops, but a place where people celebrate good local food, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you can go and be like a local, and you will find these places. I mean, even Rue Montaigu that we just mentioned before, that street was built on the site of what used to be the Mountain of Rubbish from the previous Layard Market. And so it means Mountain of Pride, because people used to think that the people that lived there were, you know, they were proud that they were living, they were nouveau riche and living on what used to be rubbish. But now, and definitely in the last 5 years or since the pandemic, I've noticed that now the Rue Montaigu is set up a lot more for the French. And so the foodie things that are there, they're for the French. You still have the Paris's oldest patisserie there, Stroheur patisserie, but there's lots of other things there. So you can go and you can, again, do that thing that we talked about with the department store, buy your cheese, buy your baguette, buy your wine, get some great chocolates, and head off down to the Layard Market and the Layard Park and maybe sit there and enjoy a great picnic.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're enjoying a culinary tour of Paris right now with Australian Francophile and food enthusiast Andrew Pryor. He teaches cooking courses out of his home in Western France, where he is also hosting a podcast called Fabulously Delicious, the French Food Podcast. Andrew has written a book, and it's called Paris, a Fabulous Food Guide to the World's Most Delicious City. His website is andrewpryorfabulously.com. Boy, you like the word fabulous, don't you, Andrew?
It's my motto, Rick. Whatever you do it fabulously.
Hey, we'll talk about fabulous. Let's talk about bakeries. I'm fascinated in Paris how the bakery scene is so developed and so appreciated and so competitive. And, of course, in France, you have this almost religion of you must have a fresh baguette for breakfast. Tell us about the passion for fresh baguettes.
Yeah, I know. It is a passion. It is almost a religion. And I think it partly comes from the fact that it's even in law, what is the ingredients of a baguette. So it's going back to this time after the revolution of making sure that everybody gets fed. And Parisians, especially now, they love a baguette. Many a Parisian will be seen walking around at the beginning of the day with one in their hand and then just nibbling on it on the end. And people actually will source and line up for a baguette. Each year there's a competition to have what is the best baguette in Paris. And when you're named the best baguette in Paris, you can then supply that to the Elysee for the year. But also you've got a lineup of people wanting it as well. So you not only got that pressure of supplying the president, but also the rest of the world, the rest of Paris.
Andrew, are baguettes still so affordable? I mean, they seem remarkably cheap compared to other things. Is it still subsidized? I mean, the French government learned 200 years ago that if you don't subsidize the bread, you're more likely to have a revolution.
Yeah. So, yes, it's still more affordable to have a baguette, but they did actually just allow them to increase the price of a baguette. And I think it was about 5 or 10 cents that they were allowed to increase the price of a baguette. But that was because,
goodness,
obviously, of global prices.
Andrew, let's just finish off our discussion. It's so appetizing, really, about Paris and about the food culture by getting your expert advice on one thing we should be sure to do in Paris if we enjoy food and want to bring home a good memory.
For sure, I think we should head down to some of the gourmet and kitchen stores that are in the first arrondissement, just down near the Layard shopping centre. Some of them are some of the oldest cooking stores in Paris, but also you get baking supply stores there, and you can just pick up something that you never knew that you needed. For any foodie out there that loves to bake, they will have great cake decorating items. So you might be able to pick up a set of piping tips that you might not be able to get back home that you've only seen in Paris.
That's a souvenir that keeps on giving. Every time you do a little pastry at home, you'll think, hey, I did that in Paris.
Exactly. Every time you're making a cake and a tart and you serve it to your friends, you'll be able to say, this came from Paris.
If I was coming to Paris tonight and you wanted to take me out to something kind of surprising and quirky in Paris for dinner, what would we experience together?
I would take you to Canard and Champagne. And so this is a really fabulous restaurant. It's in the passageways of Paris, so Passage Panorama. and they only serve duck and champagne, as the name suggests. And we would go there, have a confit de canard or a marguerite de canard and some lovely champagne together.
Oh, sign me up. Andrew Pryor, thanks so much for joining us and bon appetit.
Merci beaucoup.
See the twinkle in me eye? Just come back from France, that's why. Me and Bill went over there to spend our honeymoon. First time me and Paul and Bob. Did I like it? Bless it up. Can't say more about it than it ended up too soon. And I'd like to go again to Paris on the Seine. For Paris is a proper pantomime. And if they'd only shift the Agnew Road and plant it over there, well, I'd like to live in Paris all the time.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
The Rick Steves guidebooks originated as the handbooks for our Rick Steves tours, but these are designed to give you all the details so you can do our tours without us. From Spain to Finland and from Scotland to Greece, we've got over 50 titles, each of them lovingly updated so you can be your own guide and a dang good one. Find them at your favorite bookseller and at ricksteves.com.